All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Lonely Wrist. So today it is just half of the Lonely Wristers, and we have Braver showing up from Sweden. Introduce yourself, guys.
Yeah. Hello. Nice to be here. My name is Magnus Eppelreid. I'm one of the founders of the brand.
Yes, and I'm Johan Salin, and I'm also one of the founders and owner of Braver. So nice to be here.
Thank you for coming. I'm glad you guys showed up in numbers. This is the first ever. usually it's me and Justin interviewing people, but now you guys are showing up with strength in numbers. So it's kind of awesome.
Yeah, we're outnumbering you right now.
yeah, that's all right. So
nice to be here.
That might compensate for our English then.
You guys will be all right. I'm sure.
Exactly. We always say that we're very jealous about people having English as their mother tongue. It's so much easier, but we'll try our best to express ourselves anyway.
You guys are doing fine. So obviously we've met before. We met in California, and that was when I was exposed to your brand. And I think you guys have really something special. So
thank you.
The honor is mine as well for you guys to be hosted here. So.
Was that the first time you saw our brand, or did you know about us?
It was. So, there's a huge problem with America. Obviously, there's a huge micro brand scene. Like, everybody wants something unique on their wrist.
Yeah.
And so, the only outlet that you guys really have to get your watches in front of people's eyes is events like Wind Up and events like Intersect, where you know, micro brands will show up, showcase their portfolio. I mean, and it's really hard for us to like blindly purchase something. There's kind of what we call like an effort number here in America. And that depends on different, you know, different custom, like different people. But, you know, for me, it's really hard for me to spend more than $500 without me even seeing a watch in person, you know? So if it's 500 or below, you know, so unfortunately that leaves you guys kind of in this weird little like mark, because most of your watches, I think they start at like 800 and go up to like around 3000. So
yeah,
it leaves you guys in this weird little like pocket, you know?
Yeah. So, and that's why the Wind Up events are so great. I think we usually come to the San Francisco event and also the New York event. And it's a fantastic, opportunity for people to see the watches live from a lot of brands, of course. So
I was looking for you guys. So I was at Chicago this past year, right. And I was looking for you guys here. I didn't see you guys, unfortunately.
No.
But no, I think San Francisco and New York are great little events, and I really hope that they'll do something here, because I live in Las Vegas, so Las Vegas is a huge watch community. You know, so I'm working, like, after I have a brand that comes on, they'll come on and say, hey, like, what can we do to get involved in the Vegas scene? Like, we want to come to Vegas. Like, we want people to get our watches on their wrists in Vegas. Like, what can we do?
Yeah,
right. And we're working on creating a platform for brands like you to be able to showcase your watches in Vegas. So stay tuned for that.
Really, for sure.
Also, we really noticed that the microbrand scene or the microbrand community in US is really strong compared to Europe. I mean, we don't have any bigger fairs in Europe to participate in. We had like one smaller one in Stockholm this autumn, which was great, and then obviously I have the big ones in Switzerland, but otherwise we have to turn to US to be able to participate in a larger microbrand fair, which is kind of strange.
I think this is a great market to do it in, because the watch scene is so strong here. Like, everybody is so passionate about watches, at least within the industry or the scene, the collectors. There's tons of collectors here. There's tons of wealth and tons of like wealth of knowledge, you know, like people know what they want. People know what they're looking for. People can see right through the micro brands that aren't doing something unique. They can kind of just skip right over them. And so you have a really educated consumer here. And you know, it makes it a little easier for brands like you who are doing something unique to stand out, you know, from other brands that are essentially just reissuing a vintage diver, or, you know, taking inspiration from the 50s or 60s and you know, just creating a whole diver-centric portfolio where, you know, because that is a low-hanging fruit, you know, for some collectors. So, I think you guys are in a good spot.
Yeah,
but that was a bit, we were struggling a bit, or a bit hesitant also in the start, how it would work out to sell products that are quite expensive, after all, without people having to see them and feel them in the hands. But we were pretty surprised that, it works out great. People are getting used to buying really expensive stuff over the internet and get them shipped. And most companies also offer like free returns, and we do as well. So you can actually have a look at the watch and try it on. And if you're not happy with it, you can just ship it back. So it actually works quite well also for a bit more expensive watches.
We mainly sell abroad as well. The US is our biggest market. So most of our watches almost all the watches are bought unseen, so to speak.
Any like retail fronts, do you? Like any brick and mortars? Is it just 100% online?
Yeah, basically.
I think that's the best way to do it. You know, as long as you give people the opportunity, the platform, which you do, to see, try, and enjoy your watches. I mean, what else can us consumers ask for, right? So,
When we started, it was like 10, 11 years ago when we launched our first collection. And then we actually had a few retailers. We were sold, for instance, at Barney's in US, which were like a great start for us. But after a few years, we took the decision to only sell online, both to have better control over like the pricing of the watches, but also as it takes really a lot of time to be out on fairs to promote your watches to physical stores. And also in a way it's easy to like drown in the store with all the other brands, with big brands. The staff really need to be educated and know what to present for your brand. So we didn't really think it was worth it, to be honest, to be in brick and mortar stores.
Not only that, but there's really a hidden problem with that, and you're starting to see brands take it back to like remove this problem. But here in America, there's been a resurgence of brands opening their own boutiques. Because let's just say your watches are positioned in you know, Barney's, right? Where there's clothes and other things, right? And your brand is really just kind of there existing. You know, a lot of these brands now are kind of, as long as they have the market share to build their own brick and mortar, then they're doing it, because not only do they create that experience, but they also own the customer. You know, let's just say, for example, somebody buys a Braver from Barney's, then they're a Barney's customer. They're not really a Braver customer, weirdest way. They own one of your watches, and they possess a part of you, but you know, you don't have much means to communicate with that customer unless something goes wrong with a watch. You know, then they're like, hey, you know. You see a lot of brands that are establishing these presences now to eliminate that kind of like huge gap in the market, because that's where the long-term value is, when you possess that customer, or you have a relationship with your customer, you know? They can get into the future collections, or, you know, we'll talk about that here soon, but, you know, they can kind of progress through your portfolio with you, you know?
Absolutely. And it's really important that to sell a watch should not only be about like one time buy. It should really be to establish like a long-term relationship and to have a good contact with your audience, so to say. And as you pointed out, if you sell through physical stores, then you don't have control over that part.
Yeah. So, there, there's a big portion. So you guys may not know my past, but I sold 30 brands at a retailer. And mm-hmm. We sold everything. Like we sold Rolex, we sold Patek. I mean, we sold JLC, we sold Zenit. I mean, we sold Panerai. We sold every watch brand you could ever think of. Mm. And there's a huge portion of the market here that, you know, not only do they see it online, like they get their first exposure to it online, but then they come into a store to try it on, to get hands on with it, because, you know, this is something that you're wearing on your wrist. So it's something that's always in contact with your body. And so there's a huge portion of a feeling that goes into it. Not only like emotion, but actually, you know, everybody really cares about size, proportions, like thickness. I mean, all these things are really important, and they kind of go back towards the bigger picture of, does this watch fit, you know, me, right? So.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure.
So tell us about how Braver got started, and tell us about like your early days.
Yes, I mentioned it's 10, 11 years ago since we started the brand. We registered the company in 2011, and the first collection was launched in 2013. So it's quite a few years now that we've been running. We've been friends for many years, and for many years, we discussed starting our own brand, which eventually led to Braver. And the first collection was a Swiss-made quartz model, which launched in 2013. And then since then, we launched one more quartz model, right, Johan? Until we jumped over to our first mechanical watch, which was back in 2017. And that's also when we started assembling the watches in Sweden instead of having them Swiss made. So we still use only Swiss made movements, but we assemble all the watches in Sweden with our own watchmaker.
Tell us about some of the inspiration. Like, obviously, brands just don't start overnight. Like, there had to have been a huge gap in your eyes in the market, you know? So mm-hmm. tell us, like, what is it that made you feel like you had to start Braver?
Well, neither me nor Magnus are like watch guys from the start. We have both a background from industrial design. So we're working with anything from like medical devices to outdoor products. That's like our daily work back then. So it was not obvious that we should start a watch brand. We really wanted to create our own brand, but we were not sure about in which niche it should be. So we discussed anything from like bags to shoes and so on. But it was first when Magnus was about to buy a watch for himself, when we were out looking and kind of observing that the watch market seemed to be quite conservative, both in terms of design, but also how it was communicated, like really traditional jet fighter images for the male customers and mother of pearl and sparkling diamonds for the women, which we thought were kind of outdated. So I think that is like really the spark when we started to discuss what about moving into watch market. And back then it was really rare with micro brands. At that point when we started to discuss it, I don't even think like Daniel Wellington had even started yet. But it was not that common as it is today. But we really wanted to create a design-driven watch brand with good value for money and a more modern communication about the brand. But since then, it has, of course, evolved quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I think that's quite natural also, that you need to try out different directions before you find your niche in the end.
Yeah, you guys, something that's really unique about your brand is you really stick to like a specific sport. obviously it doesn't take long for you guys, for a consumer to go to your website and see you guys are huge into cycling. You know, what is it about cycling that fuels the brand?
Well, that was actually in one way the starting point for the brand, because that's how we got to know each other. We were both, me and Johan, were racing mountain bike back in the 90s. We were competing every weekend, and nice. We were like rivals back then. But eventually, we became friends. So yeah, in one way, it was the starting point of the brand. And it's so we've been riding. We are still cycling quite a lot and following the sport of cycling. So it's a big passion for both of us. For many years we discussed that it would be nice to combine our two passions for watches and cycling in one way or another. And finally, in 2020, we launched our first cycling-inspired collection called the Grand Tour Chronograph series. So that was really the starting point of we started to develop turn the brand more and more towards cycling, and in one way finding our own unique niche. We find a lot of inspiration from the sport. It's a sport with a very long history and a lot of tradition, a lot of secret codes, or how yeah. how you say it, like, you know, for example, we have one the rider with the race number 13 turns the race number upside down to counteract any bad luck. That's people have done it for 100 years.
Yeah,
so there are a lot of that type of symbols, and there are a lot of colors and patterns and stuff to pick inspiration from, basically.
It's actually quite cool how you guys have kind of you know, put yourself in this niche. And you know, I mean, I would think, and it seems like, you know, you guys have kind of, you know, positioned your brand, and it also seems like it's really an underserved niche, you know, because yeah. I'm sure cyclists, you know, modern cyclists maybe use a smartwatch, you know, for their heartbeat and all this and yada yada. But the fact is, like, you guys are really taking inspiration from not only the use case of a cyclist, but, you know, some of the colors and you know, some of the uniforms, like, they're really kind of like high pop, high contrast, like they stick out on the road, like, so you guys are not only taking inspiration from that, but it's a really cool niche, I think, for sure.
Thanks. And I mean, it's a lot about style as well, you know, having you're supposed to have a white socks with a certain length of the sock, the right length of the sleeve, and so there are so many aspects of this sport, and it's a lot about style. And we think that back in the days, all the riders used a nice watch. But as you say, nowadays, nobody actually needs a watch, because you have a bike computer monitoring the speed and the heartbeat and everything. But we still think it fits very well for the sport.
I agree. And, you know, your Grand Tour, to me, your Grand Tour collection is probably the most unique of your collection. I could be wrong. It's just my opinion, but it's actually collection from your brand that sticks out the most, excites me the most. So,
that's good to hear. And yeah, for sure. It's the collection that stands out the most. And, together with our new Team Heritage, series, I would say, which is our second, series inspired by cycling. So we're continuing our path within the sport of cycling, basically.
Yeah, tell us about the Team Heritage. So let me catch some of the viewers up, because obviously we've had this discussion before the podcast, but They are actually dropping a watch. I need to look at the calendar, obviously, but this is going to be posted at the day or a few days after their newest release, which is the Team Heritage, which is a cycling inspired three-hander. You know, obviously, you guys have kind of chosen different teams. Like, you've got Team Renault, you've got Team Mercer, and then you've got Team Peugeot. So yeah, tell us about the collection, and thanks for launching it with us. So
yeah, the Grand Tour collection, it's all about performance and the thrill of racing, while the Team Heritage is more looking back to like the golden era of cycling, when it was even more important to have like a nice style and hair, nice haircut and so on. So also that all the riders basically were wearing a watch back then. So the Team Heritage is picking up inspiration from classic cycling teams between like the 1950s to 1980s. And also the format of the case, it's kind of squarish design of the case with quite thick, solid steel surfaces, making it being well suited to wear. We're also on the bike, but we really take all the teams back from the days as a source of inspiration for this new collection. So initially we will then launch three teams, the Peugeot, as you say, Mercier, and Renault team. And they all have very like strong colors and patterns on the like team clothing, which we have interpreted into the design of the watches. So I think it's really good to have a strong and clear source of inspiration that can act as kind of a guiding star for us when we are developing new designs. And
Yeah, and the ambition is to, I mean, as you mentioned, we are starting with three different teams, and the ambition is to add more teams eventually. So I think it's a cooler source of inspiration than we even thought from the beginning, because there are so many cool teams, iconic teams with jerseys with strong colors and patterns and stuff that makes us come up with designs that we would never have come up with otherwise, I think.
I really dig the Renault watch. Like, love like the bound pattern that you guys have, and it takes a lot of inspiration from the older jerseys. It is a good looking watch. It's a bold watch. It's a bold move.
It is.
And then, yeah, I like the Peugeot.
Yeah. Which is a bit more clean and more graphical in its expression. So the Peugeot jersey was all white with a black, checker pattern. So that model is more clean or graphical in its expression. But still, it's got a quite unique look, because that's a really important point for us to create unique designs and not create something that looks like something else on the market. Basically, we want to create our own strong visual language, so to speak.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times you can kind of corner yourselves when you're doing these types of limited edition or, these really high design centric timepieces, because at some point when you over design a watch, it's not wearable, you know, at least for my eyes. You know, a lot of people, when they buy a watch, they focus on versatility, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you kind of have this balance of, like for example, the Renault, I mean, and even the Mercer, like they really pop on your wrist, but they're not over designed, if that makes sense. But then you've got, you know, the Piaget. I swear I'm gonna mess that up every single time.
no worries.
But
it's a tricky name.
Yeah. But this watch, like, you know, you would never know just from looking at it, like, where its inspiration is, because it is a truly wearable everyday watch because of the white dial, you know, the black indices. I mean, the really.
That's actually a really important point as well that you're mentioning here. That, I mean, even though we are definitely driven by cycling, we are inspired by cycling and very passionate about it. You should still be able to wear the watch even if you're not into cycling. I mean, it should still be a nice watch. So in general, we work with quite subtle details. We pick up like patterns and stuff that if you are into cycling, you can spot these details and understand the reference. But if you're not, it's still a nice watch and something you can wear in your everyday life.
So give us Oh, I was just going to say, give us a little taste. So you started off with these three teams. What other teams are you looking at to expand the portfolio?
Ooh,
yeah, you don't have to answer. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. I don't want to put you on the spot, but.
No. We have we have one team that is already finished.
Okay.
It's called Saint Raphael. We don't have the launch date set yet, Johan, right? But probably
next year. The launch date for the Team Heritage was set to the 2nd of April, which is just some days before the start of a big spring classic race called Paris-Roubaix. So most likely the add-ons will be launched at the start of the spring classics next year. That is the plan currently.
So you have a date in mind that you want to wrap it all around. I'm assuming, and this, you know, so we've talked with other brands before, and obviously are these like licensed? Like, did you guys have to go through like a huge licensing thing to get, or how does
No.
it? Okay. So
they are not connected to the teams in any way, and the teams doesn't exist anymore. But I mean, when we started working on the collection, I mean, the dream for us would be to be able to use actual footage of the teams. There are so much cool pictures from back then, but obviously it's quite hard to get the rights to use them. And so we are, picking up colors, textures, patterns and stuff from the teams. But they are not connected to the teams or licensed in any way. The naming of the models, they are also like a discrete way of, indicating what teams we are inspired by. So it's all the models have a three-letter name. So we have the PEU, MER, and the REN. So those the reference is that it within cycling, all the cycling teams get a official three-letter code for the team, which the International Cycling Union decides the three-letter code for the team. So that's a nod to the original teams, basically. So those three letters.
So we will not actually call it like Renault or Peugeot. It will be called REN, PEU, and so on to navigate around copyright issues.
I was looking through the collection before the podcast, and I clicked into your little folders, and it was like, I was like, they can't be calling a watch Mer. Like, what the hell does that mean? You know? And then I looked at your, you know, your document here. And then it made sense to me, you know, obviously, because I'm not a cyclist.
No.
But I think you guys slipped up here on this document, because at the very bottom of this document, I see a watch that is not in the document. What is that about?
What's that? I'm not sure.
It looks like the PEU, but it looks like it is in carbon or ceramic.
No, that's actually the PEU. So the models comes either in a steel case or a black PVD case.
Hey.
So that's why you have not seen all the variants yet.
Okay.
So that will be a variety of strap alternatives, of course, but also the choice between a stainless, a raw steel case or a PVD, black PVD case. So that's why.
I was zooming into it, like, that is a good looking watch.
Yeah.
Like, that exact configuration with the gray strap, PVD case, whoo, looks good.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool, actually.
Tell us about the Swedish soul, Swiss heart kind of thing. Like, you know, you guys have kind of coined this little phrase that you print on all your watches. Tell us how that came to be, because that's a very bold way to say you guys are Swedish, but it's also a very bold way to say you're making Swiss watches.
Yeah. I mean, as we mentioned, we are doing all assembling in Sweden. So we have a watchmaker here in our workshop where we are building all the watches per customer order, actually. And all the movements are Swiss made. So we thought that would be a little bit different compared to the classical Swiss made version or made in Sweden. I mean, we could put made in Sweden, but we think this describes the combination of our company in a better way. So the Swiss heart, and which is representing the movement, obviously, and the soul is Swedish, the mentality, the ethos, and so is Swedish. So I think that's a little nice detail that sums up the company in a quite good way.
I love it. So obviously I have a few questions that kind of segue from that. So obviously, like, when you're making a watch within your, you guys are, I'm assuming, both Swedish, you guys are both native Swedish.
Yes. Yeah.
And so obviously there has to be some association with it. And these countries set, and we've talked about this on some of the other podcasts, but these countries set criterias that have to be met. You know, for you guys to get like the moniker Swedish made. What is that for Sweden?
I know we looked it up back in the day, so I don't have the exact phrase, but it's like the last major step when the final product is taking its shape, kind of, something like that. So from a legal perspective, we could put made in Sweden on the watch as the final assembly and testing and everything is done in Sweden. So that would be fine. So it's not as in Switzerland, where a certain percentage of the cost needs to be produced in Switzerland and so on. So from legal perspective, it would be okay. But we source the components from different parts of the world. Of course, the movement is like the cost driver, but a lot of the main part of the components are produced in Asia. The leather is mainly from Sweden and so on. So it comes from different places around the world.
Obviously, first of all, Sweden is a beautiful country. For people who have never been, you should totally go. I spent quite a lot of time myself personally in Stockholm. And something that you see around Sweden, at least spending time in Sweden, is everybody and every brand is proud to be Swedish, like 100%, you know? So
yeah, you're right.
and Sweden is obviously a country that takes a very strong sense of pride in design. So how has being Swedish influenced the brand? I know that sounds so weird, but from an American perspective, the first thing that comes to mind from Swedish, I think you guys are already going to know what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
IKEA, but
yeah,
you know, so even in American minds, Sweden has a really strong design like heritage. So how has being Swedish influenced the brand?
Difficult question. Johan actually grew up in the small town where IKEA was founded.
okay.
But
everyone in my family was working at IKEA, including me. So yeah.
Wow.
And my mother were designing fabrics at IKEA as well. So yeah, we have a strong connection to IKEA. Do you have a good answer there?
No, but I mean, if we look at how we started back in 2013, I think we are our design and the look of our watches were more Swedish back then, more minimalistic. But I mean, the last few years we have, I wouldn't say that we represent the typical Swedish aesthetic nowadays or Swedish design. But I mean, yeah, we put a lot of effort into details, and maybe that's part of our Swedish heritage. I think there's a very big focus on fine details and also materials within the Swedish design tradition.
And I think one really important part is to find like the right balance between being too loud and bold versus something you want to wear on every day. For instance, like the Peugeot version on the new Team Heritage is inspired by this really bright yellow and black and white pattern on the jersey.
No, Renault.
Sorry.
Yeah.
If applying that pattern and colors directly to the whole dial, it would be way too much. So yeah, that is like an example of finding the balance. So instead, we put it in like in a lower layer, so it creates like a nice illusion that it's floating a bit, but it also calms down this pattern. So maybe this can be a representation of the Scandinavian way of finding like a good balance between making it interesting but not too much.
Yeah, when I think about Swedish design, maybe it's just because I've been to Sweden, but you know, I think ultra modern. You know, I think about like sustainability. You know, and then I ignore the fact that IKEA furniture is made to shit. But besides the point, But no, I mean, you think a lot about sustainability, you think a lot about design, you think a lot about the material use. And then, I mean, just that DNA, that Swedish DNA that defines what it is to be Swedish. I don't know what that feels like, but I've seen it and I've experienced it.
Yeah. And I also think, I mean, it's a lot about quality, I think, as well. And because we noticed that I mean, when we started the brand, we noticed when we spoke with like American press and magazines and stuff, or people in general, Sweden, despite being a very small country, it seems like people have a good image of Sweden and products from Sweden, and both when it comes to quality and design. So yeah.
Or maybe they are mixing it up with Switzerland.
Yeah, it could be. that's very, very common.
I will say, I just came back from Switzerland 3 weeks ago, and you know, obviously, I was going there and I was touring a bunch of factories. I mean, some of the people that are listening probably already know, but I was at Zenith, I was at Panerai, I was at Bouvet. I was actually with Ferlin Mari, which is a good friend of mine, Andrea, and then I went to IWC, and so we went to all these like really kind of like iconic Swiss brands, And you know, for some of the people out there that follow our channel, obviously I've been doing a lot with JJ. And so, yeah, I mean, I would like to see more watch brands coming from Sweden. What do we have to do to get more Swedish watch brands, you know, or at least,
yeah,
you know, so,
yeah,
I mean, we don't have a long history in watchmaking in Sweden. So of course, ultimately for us, it would be great to source everything in Sweden, but we don't have manufacturers of like sapphires or dials or stuff like that. So the easy way, of course, to contact like a Swiss manufacturer who can produce the watches for you. So I guess that is also why most micro brands are either Swiss made or, yeah, no name.
Yeah, Asian.
No region on them. And as mentioned, we also started with the Swiss made watches. But of course, they were also produced in Asia, all the components, and the final assembly was done in Switzerland. And we've been working with a lot of product development projects where you source the products directly in Asia. So we thought, why pay a lot of money for somebody else to source your production in Asia? And yeah, we reached out and visited several manufacturers in Asia directly to find really good quality, and then assembling it in Sweden ourselves instead.
Well, not only that too, but there's so many challenges, and we've, some of the people who have kind of progressed through our episodes of podcasts will kind of follow along with me. But you know, there's a lot of challenges that brands get faced by making watches in Switzerland. And you know, obviously people have Swiss watches are known for being high quality, but it's not always the case, you know, because it is debatable that some of the movement technology that's coming out of Japan is just as good as some of the movement, you know, for design and technology that are coming out of Switzerland. And then it just becomes a pain in the ass, like throughout the whole process of assembly and design and everything, because everything has to be considered to follow that Swiss kind of moniker that we talked about, and some brands just stray away from it because it doesn't mean it's a better watch, you know. I think that's kind of what I'm going for.
And also the fact, I mean, in our case, I mean, being a small brand, a micro brand, it's also for us much easier to have, we have much better control of the quality, and we can also, I mean, we assemble all the watches, they're made to order basically, so we make the watches that are actually sold. So that also makes it easier for us, not having to have like a lot of different color options already assembled. But we assemble the versions that we, or the models that we actually sell. So that's a very important aspect as well.
That is such a cool. So I was working with a micro brand from Switzerland. And you know, when I was going through the discovery process of them, like understanding like what was unique about them, because it was my job to help kind of communicate that messaging to the U.S. customer. Yeah. And, you know, they were, you know, I was like, oh, how many watches do you have on hand at any given time? They're like, zero. You know, we don't have any inventory. So like, you know, when an order comes in, you know, like the watch is made on the spot to order.
Yeah.
And they were never even talking about that. And I think that's so important, you know, because here in, if you look at like the American kind of manufacturing model, like everything is produced in bulk. They want to get the costs really, really tiny. And, you know, they like, you know, like if you go to any store ever, like you'll just see hundreds of something on the shelves. And that goes away from the sustainability. People don't appreciate it because a lot of times you have a lot of issues with quality control because it's been sitting there, it's been handled, it's been tossed around. It took a long time, you know, to get there. And so, you know, their approach was, we have a movement and we design a watch around a movement, and then they buy the movements in bulk, and then, you know, they'll assemble the watch, you know, to whatever the customer's order is. And we kind of were like, why don't you like talk about this? you know, because people care about this. It's like, it's like getting like a like I don't know, like you go to the bakery and like they have a little sticker on it and it says like made this day, this time, you know, like it brought me into those feelings. And and so ever since then, they've kind of rechanged their brand and now they're advertising it and people like come back and anyways, it was successful. But that's such an important thing, you know, because obviously you guys are a small brand, you know, you don't have 30 million warehouses, you know, to leave your stock in. You don't have, you know, you're not producing 30 million watches a year, you know, like you have to be kind of frugal with how you, you know, build your inventory and how you distribute your watches. You have to be strategic or else, you know, the brand that we know and love called Braber will no longer exist. Right. So,
yeah, exactly. And And it also adds a very like a personal aspect to it as well, which is very important, I think, as well. It's actually the watch is actually made for specifically for the customer ordering it. So that's also an important aspect, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you're really nowadays you're really used to when you buy something online, you get like an email a few hours later that it's already shipped. And our philosophy is that like good things are worth waiting for in a way, and it actually emphasizes the craftsmanship that goes into making a watch. And as Manu say, it's made specifically for you. We can offer some degree of customization to your watch if you want like a special surface treatment. We can do like finishing of the watch case and so on, as we are making it for you anyway.
Wow.
So I mean, you can see it as a drawback that we are small, but instead we want to see it as a positive aspect being a small and making it more personal and more options actually.
So let's say an order comes in. From the moment that order comes in to the time you dispatch the watch, what is that time period?
We normally say around 10 to 14 days.
That is not too long. Especially to assemble a watch, you know, I mean, to make sure it goes through all the quality control process. I mean, you know, people
want to do like a full control running test of the time deviation and if needed to adjust the movements and do a new control and so on. So yeah, it actually takes some time, and we don't want our watchmaker to get high blood pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. And how many watches do you guys sell a year approximately?
Around 200 watches. Somewhere around there. So really, really, really limited.
Yeah. Well, that's the cool thing. And, you know, again, I lean on, because I've talked to a lot of brands, and everybody has a unique kind of story and a unique thing. But, you know, the chances of seeing a Braber on somebody else's wrist is smaller, of course, because of the amount of output you put out. But then it also can bring you together. You know, because you guys target a unique customer, you guys are huge into cycling. It's pretty safe to say if somebody else is wearing a Braber, then they're in the cycling community, or, you know, maybe they're from Sweden or I mean, you have this. And so their customer, their archetypes, like their customer personas, like are one to one. You know, so like this other brand that we've interviewed, like they put together like events for all of their watch owners, because they're like the same type of customer profile, like and everybody gets along, everybody's like best friends, and like they feel like they've known each other for decades, and like it creates this weird kind of community. And yeah, I mean, obviously, I think as you kind of progress as a watch collector, you want to see unique watches, and unique watches tell a unique story. And so, you know, it's a higher probability that me wearing a Braber is going to get more attention than me wearing like a Rolex or whatever, right? So like, I think that's cool. you know, and it definitely doesn't have to do like volume is not important. It's more about identity than it is about volume, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
tell us about the current collection that you guys have, and tell us kind of like how each of these collections kind of expanded on the portfolio.
Nobody wants to answer. Okay. No.
I'll
answer.
So
you mean the full collection, basically?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you guys have the Grand Tour. Yeah. Now you have the Team Heritage, and then you have a few three-handers here.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, the as you mentioned, the Grand Tour chronographs and the Team Heritage, those are the newest collections. But then we also have, actually, from the very first mechanical watch we launched was a model called BW003. That's a three-hander, 39mm case. And it's featuring a Swiss-made Sellita SW300 movement. So that's one of the, or that's the first mechanical model we made. Then we have
Yeah, no, I just mentioned the ambition when creating the BW003, which is also the base for the model called Scandinavia. The idea was really to, or the ambition was to create really like your everyday companion. So we put a lot of effort into making it as slim as possible. So that's also the reason why we chose the 300 movement, because it's 1mm thinner than the SW200. And for instance, could also mention like the dials are, they are all curved towards the periphery, as well as the second hand is also bent to follow the curvature of the dial. And also it's a double dome sapphire that follows this curvature. So yeah, really put a lot of effort into making it as slim as possible, this model. Mm. So that serves the base for three models, actually, the 003, the Scandinavia model, and also our GMT, which is based around the same case but with some different design of the bezels, for instance.
And the Scandinavian model that actually, I mean, we discussed earlier a little bit about our Swedish background and our design heritage and so on, and the Scandinavia was created as a celebration of our Swedish and our Swedish design heritage, basically. So it's that one's quite minimalistic in its design.
Is that what the X represents, like the X on the dial? Like,
yeah, exactly. That's actually the four different flags. So it's a Swedish, Norwegian, Finnish,
Denmark.
Denmark. Yeah, correct.
Yeah. It's a good looking watch. Go ahead.
Yeah, so those models are more, I mean, compared to the newer models, they are much more, more graphical and more minimalistic in their expression.
What is the most, the best seller from you guys? Like, what's the most popular collection for you guys?
It's the Grand Tour series,
for sure,
and specifically the La Corsa Rossa model, which is inspired by the Giro d'Italia. So it's got the race Giro d'Italia has a pink leader's jersey for the cyclist leading the race. So it's got pink accents on the dial, and it's been very popular, I think, and has got a lot of attention, which we didn't think from the beginning, maybe that it would do so well.
Yeah, the one that stuck out to me is obviously, like we talked about this before we recorded, but when I met you guys in San Francisco, I was walking around with my friend Jessica from Zenith, and you know, Zenith is obviously known for creating iconic chronographs, and her and I were really kind of in love with the La Corsa Rossa 3. Mm. It's just it's bold, but it's not too bold, and it it I don't know how to describe it, but it's like you would never see. It's an unmarkably like I'm fumbling my words because it's so hard to describe, but it's like an unmistakable like identity. Like, you know, you've got the PVD case, and then you've got, you know, the gray dial with the tricolor pink and blue and purple like sub dial, and yeah, it's just such a good one. Such a good one.
Yeah, thanks. It became quite cool, as you say, and especially it has like a sandwich style construction. So the indices are cut out, and then it's a custom colored Superluminova paint underneath, which is the same pink color as the leader's jersey, which is then glowing in the dark, which is kind of cool when it transforms from bright pink into this green yellowish color in the dark. But it's really nice contrast between the sparkling graphite gray and these really bold accents.
And something that you don't see a lot of people do is make smaller chronographs. This is a 38 millimeter case, so you've got 38 millimeters of real estate to figure out what to do with and how to distribute it. And most of people don't, you know, most people listening don't understand how challenging of a project that is to do a 38 millimeter chronograph.
No, that was a challenge. And I mean, that was basically the smallest size we could make it. I think that's one of the most common reactions for people that might have seen the chronographs on images, and then they get to see it live. And they are surprised about how compact it is, because it's quite rare, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, it's decorated up too. Like, that's what I love about it. Like, that's what, you know, you guys, you could tell, I mean, some thought went into it. The case shape is beautiful. It curves in all the right places. And yeah, I mean, you guys aren't scared to show off, you know, the type of engine, the type of movement you guys are using, the Sellita, the 511. And yeah, I mean, just even the fonts on the dial, you know, were something that we were talking about, like the way that when you look at the seconds sub dial, like the way that the text is spaced, it's really cool. So
thanks.
I think the design of the later watches, I think this is like a part of our journey with the brand, that we came to the conclusion, okay, if we're making 200 watches, it doesn't really make sense that we are making something discreet, reminding of a lot of other watches. So we really want to make something that stands out in a good way, but otherwise it doesn't make sense for our brand to exist if we don't contribute with anything new on the market.
Can you walk us through what the design process is like for you guys? This is something that we started off really early in the podcast. Our listeners are kind of more, not only are they watch geeks, but they're more entrepreneurs and they're creative individuals. Like, so they really, really, really love it when we kind of go into the creative segment of our podcast. How does the creative process start for you guys? And how does it become an actual watch that you can put on your wrist?
I would say that we usually start to define like a concept of the watch before starting with the design. So, for instance, the Team Heritage, the concept was finding inspiration from classic cycling teams from the past. Okay, so that frames it quite well. And then we also define things like what kind of watch is it? What is the value proposition? What is the pricing of the watch? And then this act really as a good guidance for when we start with the designs. We have a clear source of inspiration that we can start off from. But maybe people find that odd that you start off with defining the concept before actually starting with design.
Yeah, and that's actually something, I mean, as mentioned, the brand has evolved during the years, and we are turning more and more focus on the sport of cycling and picking up inspiration from the sport. And that also helps us in finding inspiration and creating the design, and in a very good way, I think. So that's also a big help. And I mean, me and Johan, we work, usually it takes quite a long time to finish the design work. We work together quite closely and do a lot of iterations. I mean, in the end, when we have the final result, so to speak, we can never say that, okay, that detail was my idea or my design, because it's going back and forth between the two of us, and we're constantly, doing iterations and doing small fine tunes and working very closely together. So that's working very well, I think.
Are there any elements that you guys hope to like incorporate into some of your watches in the future? Maybe elements, maybe complications, maybe materials. Is there anything out there that you guys are looking at that you're like, this needs to be in a Braver?
We are working with a few professional cyclists, pro riders that are racing at the very top level in the world. And I mean, we have discussing about making because the pro riders are very concerned about the weight. I mean, the bikes are supposed to be as light as possible and so on. So we have discussed a really lightweight watch or something, like a climber's watch. do we have other ideas, Johan?
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, we are not really into developing any complications ourselves. We think there are plenty of good companies doing that. We want to make life easy for our wearers, that they can service the watches anywhere in the world. That is also why we choose well-known movements. So it's more about the material of the case, and as Magnus mentioned, to make optimized cycling watch that is reliable, that can withstand a lot of vibrations and so on. But otherwise, nothing in particular.
We are quite design driven, I would say, as well. Yeah. And as Johan mentioning, we're working with reliable and well-known movements and so on.
So obviously, you're talking about weight. There's two materials that immediately come to mind. Obviously, titanium. The other one, carbon. And then the third one, maybe even ceramic. So you don't have a lot of options there. Obviously, carbon being number one, and then titanium being number two, and then ceramic because of cost limitations. But they're very challenging materials to work with, as I'm sure you guys know.
Yeah, definitely. We are still on the. I mean, these are, discussions we're having. So it's nothing that we are working on right now. But I mean, that's the type of materials we have discussed.
Naturally.
Definitely. Yeah.
What's been the biggest challenge that you guys have faced as a brand, and how did you overcome that challenge?
I would say it's related to finding the right partners, suppliers. As a really small brand, small volumes, strange demands, and really high demands, high quality demands. It wasn't quite difficult to find the right partners, because they need to put a lot of effort into our projects, and they knew that the volumes were small. So I think that is like the number one challenge that we have had, and probably the same for a lot of other micro brands companies. But it's we've been in the business for quite a few years now, so we have good established connections with the suppliers now. But I would say that is, yeah, absolutely the most challenging thing when you start off.
Would you agree, Magnus?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a, I mean, yeah, that's a very challenging part. If I would was the, if I should add anything, I think it's the it's always a challenge to what to say, yeah, to be seen, basically, to get people to know that we exist and find our watches. That's of course also a big challenge, being a small brand with limited marketing budgets and so on.
Yeah,
but I totally agree with Johan as well. But that's also a challenge for us. And so, yeah, definitely.
Hopefully, we can help with the be seen part. So that's our goal.
Yeah, exactly.
And then yeah, I was waiting for because you know most people don't. I guess maybe they're scared to talk about it, and you guys don't have to, but. You know, starting a watch brand takes a lot of money. Like it takes a lot of initial capital to get going. And so I would say 7 out of 10 times people say, oh, it takes money. Like, you know, like we started off and we had like, you know, we were, you know, just coming out of college or, you know, we were broke and, you know, we literally like, you know, had no idea how to get the money to start to build a watch brand or even, you know, then we kind of came. You know, the challenge that you guys faced, which is finding suppliers and partners. But that can be a little bit easier of a challenge versus raising capital, getting money and, you know, having financial resources to support the brand, you know?
Yeah, that is a really big challenge. And to be honest, it is from time to time still challenging when you need to buy like 100 chronograph movements at the same time you need to buy 200 other movements and 300 case sets and so on. So it's really a big variations over the year. And we don't work like with a campaign or Kickstarter kind of business model. We actually produce all the watches, launching them, and then we sell them. So absolutely, this is a challenge you need to fight with. And from the start, we first couple of years, we didn't take out any salary. We put in our like savings into the company. So I think it was like 5 years ago, we could actually start working with it. so since maybe 4 years now, both of us are working full time with the watches. So it has been a long journey, a lot of hours spent outside your like a regular day job.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So that is also a good lesson that you should do something which you really enjoy and are passionate about. Otherwise, you will not manage for so many years before you can live on your hobby, so to say.
Yeah, yeah. It's an important thing to do what you're passionate about. And especially as... You know, we're creatives here as well. You know, obviously, like we're doing video content, we're doing podcasts, you know, we're doing blog posts. Like, so we're, you know, we're expressing ourselves creatively, similar to you guys. It's a challenge, you know, because you have to be creative and you have to push the envelope, but you also have to stay like true to your heart, you know, like. You know, I can't even tell you how many times brands have reached out to us and said, like, hey, here's what I want you to write. You know, here's what I want you to talk about. And I'm like, you know, sorry, like you're talking to the wrong outlet here. Like we're, you know, if we're lucky enough to get our hands on a watch, like, you know, we're going to talk about what we want to talk about.
And then,
you know, we're very community centric, you know, like we're very communal focused. Like we talk about, we don't talk so much about the products. Like we talk more about the collectors and the journey that collectors face, you know, because you see a lot of other outlets out there and they're talking about, you know, press release, boom, 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 boom. It's just like 10 press releases. And so, you know, you can go to their website and see, oh, like these are all the watches that were released this month, you know? And, you know, we're very alternative in that sense that we talk a lot about the decision making of the collector, their journey, you know, strategy. I mean, we're very community focused and we're not so much brand and product focused. And that's how we kind of segmented ourselves differently. And that, you know, like for the longest time we were, and we're transitioning now, but we were viewer powered. So like we started off kind of like on 100% donations. Like we saw people that were like, hey, you guys are watch guys. You guys know the industry, you know the scene, you know the products, like we want your perspective. And so we had a flood of donations that came in, and that powered us for this whole year, you know? And now we're kind of facing that point where like, you know, the people that donated from the start are kind of like, they're just, you know, they're just enjoying the content. They're caught up in the enjoyment of what we're producing. And so, yeah, that those donations have kind of like dried up. And so now we're kind of transitioning more into, you know, using partners to advertise, and things like that, you know, opening up new channels, you know, like YouTube is a new channel for us and a new platform. And, you know, there's challenges there, that we faced. But
I guess it's similar to building like any brand.
Of course.
You put a lot of time and effort into it before you can actually like harvest for the effort you put into it, and it can take quite some time. But you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Sure.
We have our last and final question for you guys. And you guys, a lot of people will stay silent on this, but sometimes we do get answers on this one.
Yeah.
Tell us what we can expect from you guys in the future. You know, what should we look out for? You know, if you were to say, hey, in the next decade, we want this from Braver, you know, what would that be?
Ooh. Difficult. So it's a long in the long perspective.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, I think one thing that would be cool. I think that which we discussed a little bit before about stores and selling through retail and stuff, is that it would be nice to have maybe a few of our own stores where we can. That embodies our brand. That would be, I guess it would be some kind of mix of a for watch and cycling nerds, maybe. That would be nice, I think.
Yeah.
That's my spontaneous idea, at least.
you could have a bike and a jersey and then a watch next to it, like. Every single, you know, watch is designed with this bike and this jersey in mind. That'd be cool.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. because that would be really nice, I think.
Yeah, I think we have found our niche, our combination of the two biggest passions in life. So we are really, happy during our work days when we are able to combine these interests. So. Absolutely. I said that we continue in this direction to find inspiration from the world of cycling. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the people that want to buy our watches are also into cycling. You could be either a cycling nerd or a watch nerd and appreciate the design anyway. But I think really that we found a clear niche to move forward and expanding our collection within. So that is what you can expect from us, and of course to see us around during like wind up shows and similar events, and really really happy to meet people out there.
And also continue to try to create unique designs. Basically, that's a very important mission for us.
there has to be, and this is again, you've kind of inspired me to ask another follow up question.
Okay,
but there has to be like a milestone moment for you guys where you're like, okay, if we're shipping 1,000 watches a year, or you know, this person gets our watch on their wrist, or like there has to be a milestone moment for your brand So maybe you guys haven't thought about this, but is there a is there going to be one of those milestone moments where you're like, oh shit, like we did this, you know? Obviously you guys are producing watches and you guys are selling watches, but there's got to be something in your mind like you know, as if Michael Jordan started to wear his first pair of Nikes or something, you know what I mean? Like what would that moment be for you?
I think it would be to again related to cycling, to have our own cycling team at a very high level, or be a partner of a cycling team. That would be very cool, I think. We have actually been a partner of a professional cycling team a couple of years ago. But I mean, to be like a naming partner of a team?
Yeah, I'm sorry? Sponsoring partner.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. For a team that actually... where our brand name is included in the team name would be very cool, I think.
That'd be pretty amazing.
So that's probably our dream.
What about you, Johanna? I saw you were trying to get some words out there.
No, I mean, I was thinking like about a specific rider who would be cool to be seen on. We have some pro riders who are wearing the watches, but there is like one big star in my favorite rider. It's called Mathieu van der Poel. And that would be really, really optimal to be seen on his wrist. So let's hope for that. And one of the Team Heritage models was actually the team his grandpa used to race for. So maybe there is a chance.
I'll shoot him a text message.
Yeah, please do.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for your time. I know we've went over a lot here in this just over an hour. Is there anything, you know, I would like to give you the platform. Is there anything you feel like we didn't touch that's important? Maybe initiatives, goals? I mean, is there anything you feel like we kind of missed over here?
I don't think so. Sorry, John.
Could it be that we missed talking about our new vintage team car?
Yeah, that's right.
Please. Yeah, I mean...
We're talking about creating a concept before we start with the design. We also decided really early that we need to have a dedicated team car for the new Team Heritage collection. So we acquired an old Volvo 145 from the 70s, which is under transformation now to be like service car for old cycling teams. So the plan is to take it down to Europe and visit some of the big cycling races with it, and also to promote the brand, of course.
That sounds like something you need to document. So I hope and I cross my fingers that you guys are going to film that, because I would love to watch that. Like the process of building the car and bringing, you know, some of the design into it, maybe some of the paints and maybe, you know, some of the decals and whatever you guys do. Like, I think that would be crazy.
Yeah, so, we'll do that.
So do us a favor and film it. And then I will happily put on the podcast or the website, and I will happily, you know, share that journey with you guys and everybody else, right? You know, because that's, you know, we talked about this a lot. If you look at like vlogging, for example, it was really popular back in the day, but then you look at, you know, people who have grown with you, you know, like if you look at, I know this is a really weird example, but if you look at the Kardashian TV show, you know, like people have grown up with the Kardashians, and like they've witnessed their journey, and they've faced challenges with them on TV. And the same thing for any reality TV show. So like, you know, that is where, you know, you guys will start to get your cult status, you know? So
exactly. Hopefully. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. We will definitely share our trips with the car.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, thanks again so much for coming on. We're going to wrap this up. Thanks so to Magnus and Johan from Braver. I appreciate you guys. Thanks for outnumbering me. Thanks for showing up in crowd, and thanks for taking some of our challenging questions. I'm personally looking forward to what you guys are doing. I'm a huge fan. I'm humbled that you guys have spent some time with me. And you know, we're gonna follow up with you guys here soon. Obviously, we're going to stay in touch, and you know, we're going to be communicating and staying in touch and distributing and helping you kind of, you know, reach your goals for the brand. So we're a partner. So
yeah,
we'll great to hear. We'll definitely talk here soon, guys.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you a lot, Mike. Nice to have us.
Take care, guys.
Take care.
Ciao.